You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Russian Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the evening of September 14th, 2024. I want to make an announcement, first of all, that my P.O. Box in Tyre Hill has been closed. If anybody insists on sending me something absolutely by snail mail, contact me on Skype. That's Saint Sava, ST_Sava. And I'll give you a usable address. And speaking of which, I do this all the time, but it moves me greatly to see the generosity of my supporters, not only because it supports me and keeps my independence and is totally responsible for my independence, but it also is a huge vote of confidence from many of you. So that being said, last Thursday I dealt with, of course, the war in Ukraine, and we mentioned Poltava. I should say my Daily Nationalist. I don't know if it comes out on Thursday anymore or what, but Daily Nationalist touched on the city of Poltava, and that got me thinking of the Great Northern War, and it got me thinking of Peter the Great, Ivan Mazepa, and we're going to talk about Sweden, their defeat under Charles the XII, and the defeat of Cossack autonomy, too, at the same time. I began reading people like Nicholas Dorel, Robert Frost, Nisbet Bain, Gary Dean Peterson, Henrik Lunde, Derek McKay, so many others, Derek Wilson, and tried to put together as coherently as possible, though this is a particularly complicated war, an account of the war, what it did for Russia, and why the Swedes failed. Part of the reason that this is complicated is that we're dealing with a lot of areas that were sovereign by the dawn of the 18th century. Places like, you know, Saxony, Holstein-Gottorp, and places like that. Small, but in many cases wealthy. Especially if these places are along the Baltic Sea route. And the war, of course, took place almost exclusively there, with the exception of the military battles farther south in Ukraine and parts of Poland. The Great Northern War changed everything. It completely redrew the map of Europe and European political life, especially Central Europe. It began very conveniently in 1700 and ended in 1721. And one of the more important aspects of this is that Sweden was no longer an imperial power. From there on in, it was a neutral power, of course, until now. At no point during the Cold War did the U.S. demand that Finland and Sweden abandon their neutrality and take up arms against the Soviet Union, but of course it's happening right now. So I thought it was fitting to deal with this. So not only was Sweden eliminated as a great power, or at least a great hegemon in the north, but Russia was yet again reminding Europe what it was. And this was no ordinary Russia. Many of you know that I have been very harsh on Peter I, Peter the Great, and with very good reason. But this was Peter's first important test militarily, and he won. And we're going to get to more of that here in a little bit. In my mind, it doesn't justify what he did to get there. And part of the reason that Sweden lost is that Peter, like the Bolsheviks, didn't care how many people he had to throw into the grinder. But up until the Russian confrontation, Sweden's power in Northern Europe was fairly extraordinary. It was the anchor of the Protestant powers. But that led, especially dealing with a wealthy area, a tremendous wealth going back and forth in the Baltic Sea, created a coalition opposed to the Swedish Empire. Frederick IV of Denmark, which also included Norway at the time, Augustus II, who was king of Poland and Saxony, which joined those two powers. Then much later, 1715, Prussia under Frederick joined. And many of the smaller places, such as Saxony and Gottorp, these were places, Hanover, that didn't necessarily have, and Poland was one of these at the time, didn't have access to the sea. And the smaller states were seeking this, and extremely important. Charles XII, of course, the boy king of Sweden, broke this alliance by 1706. However, Russia defeated him. And much later, Britain and the Empire's Elector in Hanover also came into this alliance. Again, in Hanover, it was landlocked, and only by joining the anti-Swedish alliance could it have access to the sea. Holstein may be another example of this, which was ruled by Sweden at the time. No one denies that Charles XII was one of the most able leaders, young or old, of his age. Now, while the anti-Swedish side had Augustus in Poland, the Swedish campaign against the Polish Empire led to Charles installing Stanislaus I, Leszczynski, on the throne in Krakow. And it joined Holstein, that part of Poland, and Ivan Mazepa together. When you grow that powerful, no matter how well you're run as a nation and an empire, you're going to make enemies. The war on the Swedish Empire began with simultaneous attacks. Holstein-Gottorp was between, you know, that area between Germany and Denmark, Livonia and Ingria, coming close to St. Petersburg on the other side, which at the time were all ruled by Sweden. This turns out to be a huge miscalculation, because in response, Charles XII shows what he is made of. In fact, he drove Augustus of Poland straight back to his lands in Saxony. In 1706, Augustus was removed entirely, and Stanislaus I was installed. Almost the entire war, with the exception of the Poltava, that area of campaign, took place within and around the Baltic Sea. This is the core of Northern Europe. Sweden, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Finland, Estonia, Norway, Denmark, Germany, Russia, and so many of these smaller entities that don't really exist as independent states anymore. Through this sea went much of the grain through Central Europe, even North Russia, to the markets of Western and Northern Europe. So from 1560 to 1658 was this period of expansion of Sweden, and the Baltic Sea was its core. And that also meant that it came into contact with Russian regions, Karelia, Ingria, Livonia. And the coalition against Sweden that I mentioned before was called the Northern Union, and it was really made up of those who had been defeated by Sweden in the past. I should note that the Thirty Years' War, and so many of the religious wars too, allowed Sweden to take Pomerania, that region that's split between Poland and Germany, the southern part of the Baltic Sea. The Norwegian-Danish alliance had key lands conquered in 1650-1658 by this same Swedish Empire. Now, in Russia's case, the Time of Troubles, the Treaty of Stolbova in 1617, drove Russia out of this region, at least temporarily. Retaking it was one of Peter's actual legitimate goals. But that was long ago. But any ruler of Russia would have to retake this area. 1617 was a huge blow to Moscow. I mean, this was the whole purpose of the Livonian Wars under Ivan the Terrible. Sweden was impressive. It's not a huge place. It's sparsely, at least was sparsely populated. But what they lacked in numbers and size, they made up for in quality. It was sort of like an earlier version of Prussia. It's a very well-trained, very well-drilled, but fairly small army. And it really wasn't until the rise of Prussia that this kind of professionalism was ever seen. What made the Swedish Empire is homogeneity. Competent, centralized royal rule based on this racial connection. That also led to a unified, well-educated bureaucracy in the 17th century that could, at least up to a limit, support any army or navy in the field. So this national racial centralism and sense of patriotism created the Swedish Empire. Cohesion, not numbers, built it. Now, the problem is whether or not this could work over a long campaign and actually proved its undoing. The answer was no, it couldn't. Sweden, whether or not Sweden was a land power, I tend to think it was. But then again, it was a Protestant power, it was a Lutheran power. I'm on the fence as to where in that spectrum it lay. Now, despite the racial homogeneity of Sweden, they did have to use Scottish and German mercenaries, although they were commanded by Swedish officers. One of the aspects of this professionalism was its reliance on cavalry, on horses, which it invested quite a bit in, and that made it almost a very early version of a mobile force. Her weaponry was first rate, and it could move very quickly. But her small size actually mattered as this war dragged on. Sweden could not win a war of attrition. And this is an era where wars were becoming more costly, more elaborate. The way that you would finance a land war in the past, like plunder or taxation, this wasn't sufficient anymore. It didn't take long for Sweden to feel this kind of pain. But at the beginning of the 18th century, the Swedish Empire was no doubt the dominant power in the Baltic Sea and the core, really the anchor of the Protestant powers in the religious wars prior to this. As I mentioned, the territory would include the Baltic coast for the most part, the entire region of the Gulf of Finland, of course the Baltic states. But in 1697, Sweden was led by a 15-year-old. And this boy became Charles XII, gave this new coalition, Denmark, Norway, Saxony, and Russia, and of course Augustus's Poland to the extent that he could last there. Because he was young, it gave them an opening to press any territorial claims they may have had, as I said, called the Northern Union. It was Saxony and King of Poland, monarch there that joined these lands, Augustus II, that was the first to create this. The purpose of taking Swedish Livonia. And that was the only thing that would allow him to strengthen his power in Poland, Lithuania, and allow him to have a very strong, uncontested access to the sea. In 1660, Livonia was under Swedish control. But because of the Saxon-Polish unity under Augustus, Charles campaigns in Poland against him, and that's what brought him into a connection with Ukraine and the Cossack host. Denmark, too, driven into the conflict by a long-standing rivalry over the Baltic Sea. Prior to this, Charles X defeated the Danes and seized a substantial number of lands just south of the peninsula of Scandinavia. One of the things that Denmark lost was its revenue, the so-called sound dues. This is the collection of rents on ships passing through the Sound leading into the North Sea. Because you have Denmark, Holstein-Gottorp, and Germany, northern Germany, forming the entryway from the Baltic to the North Sea. And the two countries were also competing over Schleswig-Holstein, which was the northernmost part of the, you know, what was at the time the German Confederation. Peter the Great was a latecomer in the Northern Union, because this area, especially to the east, was essential to the Russian economy. The immediate cause, from the Russian point of view, Russia was at war with Turkey until 1700. Therefore, it wasn't going to fight on two substantial fronts. But when war was declared on Sweden, it could only be after a peace treaty was signed in Turkey. The confiscation of all Swedish goods in Moscow and cities to the north were confiscated, and the Swedish envoy in his office was arrested. Now, there's something called the Riga Incident of 1697. This is something I've dealt with before. I'm not going to get into whether or not it was actually Peter who was in this great embassy to bring Russians in contact with Western capitals. He was supposed to be incognito, which I find very hard to believe given his size. But for whatever reason, when he came to Riga, under Sweden at the time, he was harshly received. But that was just a pretext. Peter wanted to take Ingria and Karelia, that is to say, those regions bordering the Gulf of Finland, which were lost at the beginning of the 17th century, as I mentioned. Because of all of this, there was a declaration of war in the Swedish Empire on Russia. They didn't talk about any previous wars, but the declaration itself talks about the untruths and grievances put upon the Swedish Empire and the West in general by the Russians. It was a very similar claim to today. Because the declaration of war was very vague, there's a few people, the scholars that I've mentioned already, that this is a way to give the young Charles a blank check to stir up patriotic feelings in Sweden. He knew casualties were going to be high in any war, although he didn't have a high opinion of Russia, at least for a time. He needed a justification for any negative conduct during the war. He needed to stabilize elites in the face of high casualties, and I really should say inevitable dislocation, like all wars do, especially over time. But there was really only one reason for Russia's involvement, and that was access to the Baltic Sea. Anything else really was secondary. The war with Turkey at the same time was over the Azov Sea, and he wasn't going to do both wars at the same time. But as that war was going on, Peter was going to give the Swedes some of this land in the north only to preserve what we now call St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg in the Gulf, the very end of the Gulf of Finland, symbolized for Peter access to the Baltic Sea and hence a window to the Western world. Yes, Peter was victorious, but at a great cost. So it was in the late summer of 1700 that Peter the Great finally was able to put an end to the war with Turkey, the Treaty of Constantinople. By now, Denmark had already withdrawn from the war, which was raging. It started in 1700. Very quickly, and without much preparation, Russian troops were sent out on its first campaign due to a treaty signed with Augustus II. In the event of any victory over Sweden, in alliance with him, Russia was going to take Ingria, basically what's today Petersburg, that region. The border between Ingria and Estonia was the fortress of Narva. And that was the first real goal of the Russian high command, such as it was. We all know what it's like to travel in Russia. If anyone should have known this, Peter the Great should have known this. And yet on the Russian march to the Narva, this was, by the way, close to Pskov, the border of Estonia and Ingria, as I mentioned. It was very poorly organized. It was done very quickly. The rains, poor condition of the roads, and very poor supplies. Soldiers were not fed properly, did not have proper supplies. The horses were not of high quality. But the plan was to concentrate 60,000 men at this fortress, at Narva. But the army moved very slowly. Remember, the army was in the process of being reorganized. There was a period of chaos prior to Peter coming of age and taking over. October 14th, 1700, Peter only had about 40,000 men laying siege to Narva and really the neighboring fortress of Ungarod. Russian guns were a little on the light side. And the ammunition was still insufficient because much of it was still on the Turkish front. So Narva was now a double fortress, as many have said. So the manpower that Peter could put together was stretched to the limit, having to surround both fortresses. And their already rough condition led to Peter's huge loss, the Battle of Narva. Now, Augustus of Saxony and Poland, he learned of Denmark's removal from the war. He was in the process of putting the city of Riga under siege. He lifted that to head towards the Narva, but that means more Swedish forces were available. These forces landed on October 6th, headed for the fortress of Narva, which was besieged at the time. Peter put the army in the hands of a Saxon, what we would call field marshal, Charles Duke de Croix. Charles only had about 10,000, not between 9 and 10,000 men with him. A heavy defeat was inflicted on the Russian Empire. Duke de Croix himself surrendered before it was clear that the war was lost. And his staff was almost entirely foreign, which was entirely the fault of Peter. So by late fall, even though Russian infantry outnumbered the Swedish, they were able to sign a surrender, but the losses were catastrophic, not to mention the humiliation of the Russian Empire in front of Europe. Estimates vary as to those who died of all causes, between 6 and 10,000 men. 10 generals were captured, actually almost 100 officers, and all of their artillery was taken. But this could be laid at the doorstep of poor preparations. Maybe some of this is starting to sound familiar to you. An army in the process of reorganization, bringing in certain European ideas, now fighting a dominant European power, a strong, well-led enemy on its home turf. 18th century Russian, military linear tactics were not known. And even if it were, imposing this on Russian infantry was another matter. Reconnaissance, things like that, were outside of the Russian norm. And partially this is because the state, despite propaganda to the contrary, was not centralized at all. Because of the Turkish War and the haste in which this campaign was launched, the Russians were poorly armed. Making matters worse, the Russian army, again, without a centralized command, Russia had something like 25 different calibers of not just small arms, but artillery. Was very much complicated, the supply, and strategy. But as many have said in the past, because the state was not centralized, there was no, like we would call the chiefs of staff, there was no national chain of command. And some of the main positions were under the control of foreigners imported by Peter the Great. But I can say even Peter the Great was not trusted. This defeat almost cost him the throne. The only good thing it created was a belief in Charles's mind that Russia was incapable of fielding a competent army. Now, after the Russian defeat, Peter went back to the drawing board. He said that foreigners can't be controlling this army. He limited foreigners to no more than one-third of the total number of officers in any particular unit. The Russian army changed radically because of this defeat. The Narva was a very important goal because the entire purpose of all of this was access to the Baltic Sea and gaining control over the trading ports along the Baltic, surrounding the water. Now, later on, Narva would be atoned for by Poltava, but Peter, at a minimum, taking resources wherever he could, sometimes good, sometimes bad, dedicated himself to building a stronger Russian navy, which occurred very quickly, and a new European-style army. Peter rebuilt Russian forces. And this later campaign is what would, you know, free the area that we call St. Petersburg. And as the war came to a close, Russia then had an unquestioned rule over the Baltic Sea. Charles aimed his guns at Russia once his military actions in the West were finished. He was able to consolidate his forces. This is what Charles XII set out as his goals prior to the, you know, more or less organized invasion of Russia, both to the east and to the south. The complete destruction of any independence of the Russian state. He also possibly wanted to be able to attack and take Moscow. He wanted to overthrow Peter and place either King Jan III's son, Jacob, on the throne, or maybe Peter's son, Alexei, so long as, you know, they could be, you know, do Europe's bidding. He wanted to reduce Russia to its former Kievan-era appanage principalities, to separate Pskov and Novgorod from Moscow, really detaching the entire north of Russia and parceling it out to Sweden or Poland. Then the annexation of Ukraine, really a lot of the, you know, Belarus, the western Russian territories to Poland. At the time, Poland was now ruled by Charles's vassal, meaning that Russia was to be no more, at least as a unified entity, and nothing has changed since then. These plans that he first wrote down didn't quite play out, and he was always changing them, and his commanders around him were not aware of them. He was going to rely on Generals Adam Lewenhaupt and George Liebecker. The decisive battle was going to be in this northern swampy region of Pskov, maybe even to attack Moscow simultaneously. The other problem that Charles fell into, almost a trap, was that he overestimated the rebellious nature of the Russian population relative to Peter. This is one of the reasons that Charles thought that an attack on Moscow would make some sense. Because he was a young man, he surrounded himself with young commanders, Spada, Lagerkrum. Not to mention the fact he also underestimated the reform of the army under Peter. Liebecker attacked from Finland, Stromberg from Estonia. However, the invasion ended in miserable failure. What we know today is a great northern war. Generally doesn't, you know, places like Denmark don't come up. What comes up is Charles XII and Peter the Great. was in 1708, New Year's, that the Swedes, about 40,000 men, which seems to be an awfully low number, in Poland, crossed the River Vistula into Russia. He realized that the mud and the rain prior to this, he actually started his mobilization in 1707, but he overestimated his abilities in this regard too. By the summer of 1709, the invasion ground to a halt, and what had been the Russian humiliation at Narva was now the Swedish humiliation of Poltava, a few hundred miles south of the Baltics. On the other hand, prior to all this, the successful campaign in Poland led to Augustus II being overthrown, replaced by Stanislaus. Charles was pretty brilliant at consolidating his gains in Northern Europe before turning on Russia. He still believed, though, that the time of troubles, got 80 years earlier, kept Russia as an easy target. Supply was a huge problem because his army was very fast moving. He had a huge proportion of his military force based on horses. He could be always on the move. It would permit him to overtake any army at great speed. But of course, we know what the Russian strategy was at the time: to draw this fairly small Swedish force deep into the country, making life miserable along the way. Now, most of the authors I cited you argue that after the Russian defeat at Narva, Charles should have pursued the Russian forces deeper into the country. But he was waiting for one person, and that was Hetman Ivan Mazepa. Connecting Charles's campaign in Russia to both Ukraine and Turkey. Of course, the deeper he went into Russia, the more difficult it was for reinforcements and supplies to keep up with a force as mobile as his. As they're being drawn into Russia, they're subject to constant harassment, Russian paramilitary and even civilians attacking the supply lines. Reinforcements were intercepted, ambushed then by Russian regular troops under the command of Alexander Menshikov. Before they could even meet the main body of Swedish forces. But Poltava was the most decisive battle of the Great Northern War. And it's one of these things that justified Peter's continued reforms. Because nothing consolidates and justifies a position of power like a victorious war, especially against an opponent that had just recently defeated you. Swedish army came under the command of Carl Gustav Reinskold. He was respected, but he was forced to work with very little. Now, first 6 years of the war, prior to the Russian issue, Sweden seemed absolutely untouchable, especially when he took Poland and placed Stanislaus on the throne. This began the next 90 years, began this long, drawn-out decline of the Polish state to where it was no more. By the time Charles began to move both south and east towards the Cossacks, everything in the west had been taken care of. There was only one member of the old coalition left, and that was Russia. But Charles' forces hadn't, for any length of time, put up with these vast lands or unpredictable weather, especially going north to south. Russian mud isn't like mud anywhere else. I guess the closest you can get to it is like mud in Alabama. Very different chemical compounds. Russian mud was like no other. It could bring movement to a halt if you're not ready for it. Of course, the Russians, unfortunately, used scorched earth tactics, partisan harassment, even shock attacks by irregular Russians. Again, this was what brought Charles to the end of his competence. Between 1707 and 1709, his thrust towards Moscow, made possible by marching south to establish his winter quarters in Cossack territory. By the time the weather cleared, a few months later, the Swedish army was very weak. It was only in the spring of 1709 that Poltava, which was a fortress, was placed under siege. Poltava in Ukraine is a important trading center and military headquarters. Now, the numbers that Russia was able to put out at this point was about 80,000 men personally commanded by the emperor. And this is where Peter was going. He was heading to lift the siege of Poltava, of course, today in northeastern Ukraine. But by this point, by the spring of 1709, the Swedish force, Charles's force, was about half of its original size. Very much like in World War II, that winter, 1708-1709, was one of the coldest in 500 years. Charles had 20,000 men at his disposal, maybe 30 cannons. And worse than that, the plague hit the Swedes in Ukraine. And he's short on supplies. It was under this condition that he put Poltava, the fortress, on the Vorskla River under siege, starting in May of 1709. The point of Peter's march there was to relieve the siege. Charles, on June 20th of that year, was struck in the foot by a stray bullet. Many of you know this already. I don't know if it got infected, but he had a tough time standing. You had anti-Swedish confederations in Poland. You know, a confederation is a collection of powerful magnate families, oligarchs. Poland was never really a state so much as a federation of these powerful magnate families. A confederation is when more than one came together, usually temporarily, to fight for a specific interest. The region we're talking about here, too, is surrounded by very dense forest. And the two we're talking about formed kind of a corridor. The Russian strategy was far more sophisticated than they're normally, you know, given credit for. They were going to build what they call redoubts. A redoubt is a mini fort, making access to the real fort much more difficult. He wanted to have 10 of these little forts. These little forts, the redoubt didn't really have a flanking fire, but when you arrange it like this, when you have so many of them, it can. The final two were still being built at the time. But about 4,000 Russian men were at the 8 that had already been built. Behind them was Alexander Menshikov's 10,000-man cavalry force. Reinskold ended up taking over the Swedish command because of his wound, Charles's wound. What they were going to try to do was no surprise to anybody, was rely on their speed to bypass these dug-in redoubt positions, the smaller fortresses, and hit the main one using speed. Now, the infantry was in place, but the cavalry, because these guys got a little lost, they were not on their territory, the cavalry arrived too late to matter. They had lost the element of surprise. They didn't have the proper cannon to do this. The Swedes decided to go ahead with the attack anyway. It was almost daylight. And another general always reminded me of Jeb Stuart. Carl Gustav Ruse took several of these small forts, these redoubts. The third one, however, stalled. Connection between Lewenhaupt and Ruse, their communication was a problem. The orders lacked clarity, whether to avoid these little fortresses, these redoubts, or to attack them one after another. It was early morning that the two flanks of the Swedish army went past this back line of the redoubts. Russian cavalry was sent in a strategic retreat. They did not pursue them yet again. Russian cavalry and Skoropadsky's pro-Russian Cossacks waited. 13 Russian battalions deployed just north of that camp, anticipating the Swedish advance. Russia clearly ruled in terms of cavalry and manpower, not to mention this is basically their territory. The Russians successfully isolated General Ruse's 6 battalions from the rest. High casualties. Many of them then ran into the two forests that created this corridor. They reoccupied the little forts that they had constructed, dug themselves in even deeper. But Rus' forces had already surrendered, and the Swedes had waited for his men. Peter had 42 battalions, 22,000 men, into an advance out of the fortified camp, supported by over 50 heavy cannon, 32 guns on the ramparts, and then 10 regiments of dragoons under General Adolf Bauer. They had a huge and well-equipped army this time, and this was faced by 4,000 Swedish infantry under Karl Kreutz, and the weather was nasty. Swedes fired what cannons they could, forcing the Russians to retreat, but not for long. Many of the Swedes simply were incapable of fighting at this point. It was extremely hot and humid, and they were very sick. It's no coincidence that the plague would arise in this very heated environment. Isolation of these different Swedish units is what caused the Russians to be able to win, isolating one from another, causing a panic. Menshikov was an able commander, outflanked the Swedes, and attacked them then from behind. At this point, there was no organization. Sweden was in pure chaos. A handful fled to the forest. Charles ruled over the very last number of formations of Swedes on the battlefield. The Russians halted at the edge of the woods, pulled back their artillery, and allowed the Cossacks and Kalmyks, which is a tribal group from the far south, to try to arrest as many as possible. Charles had maybe 2,000 men left. His baggage train was like 3 miles long, and the battle was over at that point. Those who tried to run were captured. You had some high-ranking Swedish officers and nobles that were captured. Reinskold was one. Schlippenbach, Stackelberg, Hamilton, Prince Maximilian Emanuel, so many others. The loss was more humiliating than the Russian loss at Narva. Now, less agreeable than all of this was the scorched earth policy. And Peter insisted on maintaining that in a few places, but it's self-destruction and almost a defeat in and of itself. And I'm telling you, and I said this before, Peter the Great had very little respect for human life, including his own. He was, in essence, a foreigner. Assets were either burned, capital was burned, or more commonly hidden from the Swedish force, which was always in trouble, supply-wise. The development of a fast cavalry corps and mobile units completely outpaced the technology of resupply. It was okay if this was in the border areas of the Baltic Sea, but now you're deep into a foreign country. This is where Sweden's lack of manpower and resources led to an army and a supply line that were extremely vulnerable. I mentioned the bitter cold in 1709. Battle of Poltava. I know, very briefly went over what happened. Poltava was the greatest military catastrophe in Swedish history. Now, the war continued after 1709, of course, but not like it had been before. It was a complete turning point. The anti-Swedish coalition, which was allegedly dead and buried, was resurrected. Now the Swedish Empire was bereft of its best men, and these forces, I mentioned already, attacked on several fronts. Poltava meant that Sweden was no longer a regional hegemon in Northern Europe. The Baltic Sea became a Russian sea more than a Swedish one. And essentially, that's what this war was fought to bring about. The Swedish Empire never gained any more territory after Poltava. The British were involved in this. Prussia was involved in this. Russia maintained its conquered possessions in the Baltic, consolidated its hold over Ukraine and Poland, built St. Petersburg, and of course now was central in the Baltic grain trade. Now, all of that being said, I want to talk about someone that's in my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, and that's Hetman Ivan Mazepa. One of the more interesting aspects of the Great Northern War was the defection of the Hetman Ivan and his alliance with Charles XII. Remember, this is an era where Peter was modernizing the Russian military, although at great cost, and was dedicated to recapturing lost territories I've already mentioned. Now, I've dealt with Peter many times in writings and in verbally, lectures, very unsympathetically. Everything came at a cost that was way too high to justify it. His reforms led to a European-style army. But if you're Ivan Mazepa and you're in Hetmanate in Ukraine, you're facing a man like Peter the Great, who had just a total callous disregard for human life, loathing traditional Russia, of which the Cossacks were a big part, because the army had become European. The empire was no longer a Russian nation state, but a European empire. In fact, Peter the Great called himself emperor, not czar. Russia finally was beginning its centralization, this mechanized European state under centralized control. This was a modern, revolutionary, and so-called scientific doctrine. And if you're a non-status actor, a medievalist, knightly order like the Cossacks, both at the Hetmanate and at the Sich, the fortress at Zaporozhye, you realize that you're in serious trouble. The Sich was just a warrior camp, but the Hetmanate was a fully functional society. The fortress beyond the rapids, the Sich, was traditionally more radical and egalitarian, strictly made up of Orthodox experienced soldiers. But again, the Hetmanate was different from this. It was a normal country that had bureaucrats, that had traders, like everything else. But the Sich was a knightly castle, open only to warriors. And the wealth that was growing in the Hetmanate under Mazepa, and really previous to that, was starting to bother them. But they both knew that Cossack autonomy was quite possibly coming to an end. Given how Peter viewed manpower, Peter the Great wanted to control the Zaporozhian Cossack Sich as well as the Hetmanate. And what he did was typically bloodthirsty. He recklessly mobilized them to fight Turkey, far from home. He claimed that the Cossacks were part of the Russian army rather than an autonomous corporation, which was designed to rescue Slavic slaves from the Jewish island of Kaffa, and they were to keep the very porous southwestern border under control. Now, the modernist revolutionary idea of the state that Peter adopted had a full monopoly on force, on violent force. So that means in Peter's world that it can't offer autonomy for anyone, especially in the military realm. Cossacks were sent all over the place, Livonia, Lithuania, this frozen, unfamiliar territory. That means, of course, having to leave their homeland. Their own society was threatened by Tartars, powerful Polish magnates. To control these groups was the whole purpose of the Cossack host in the first place. Peter was aware that the Cossacks were opponents of his. Men in Peter's world were to be ground up for any reason. The Cossack army was never trained for any war in the far north. Their tactics were aimed at both the sea and the flat steppe, not the cold forests. The Cossacks began to suffer heavy casualties. Mazepa, of course, saw this disaster. Also, on top of all that, heard people saying that Peter wanted him replaced by one of the many Russian generals floating around. Making matters even worse than that, Peter had refused to defend Ukraine against the Polish oligarchs. I've dealt with the Treaty of Andrusovo and its long history elsewhere. Peter was aware that some of the Polish oligarchs were serving Stanislaus, placed in power by Charles XII. And Peter expected that Charles would be attacking soon. Mazeppa said that using us all over the place violates the treaty that brought us into some indirect relationship with Russia, the Treaty of Pereslav, after Khmelnytsky's rebellion. Since Russia now had, and partially because Russia had refused to protect their own territory, for a foreigner's glory. So in 1708, the Swedish and Polish forces advanced towards Mazeppa. He signed this agreement, but only about 3,500 men answered. The rest of the Cossacks were either neutral or serving either the Russian or the Polish state. Mazeppa had declared, in essence, independence. And he was correct to do so. He was threatened by a hostile imperium seeking to colonize their lands and impose serfdom, which they had already done after the Treaty of Andrusovo. Charles, however, promised full independence of the Hetmanate, which is something that they could probably promise because Sweden was in no position to rule a place that far away and foreign, even indirectly. Keep in mind that Peter had already stocked the Orthodox Church with his friends. That's part of the reason why Mazeppa's call fell on deaf ears. The Church had condemned and anathematized Mazeppa. Again, this newly purged church staffed with Peter's allies. Peter sent an army to sack and to level the Hetman's capital, Baturin, killing everyone inside, whether military or not. And there's a sack of Baturin, which is fairly well attested to. Those who basically sided with Peter elected Ivan Skoropadsky in 1708. Civilians in Cossack lands, in the Hetmanate, they lived in fear. But the big support that Hetman Mazeppa enjoyed came from Cossacks beyond the rapids. That is to say, there's a Porozian Sikh. This was their cause too. Remember, the old belief had penetrated deep into the Cossack host, whether it be in the Hetmanate or beyond the rapids of the Dnieper. Peter was Antichrist, according to the old believers. Typical of Peter, the massacres by his men, the punishment of Cossacks collectively. He ordered the Sikh to be leveled in 1709. Any Zaporozhian Cossack could be executed wherever he was found. So yes, they had good reason to believe that Peter was Antichrist. If not the Antichrist, then a Antichrist. The Battle of Poltava was fought by a broken Swedish and Cossack force, or at least Swedish force, and a fresh and competently led Russian force. Mazeppa was then on his own once Peter's victory was manifest. Charles, still badly wounded, fled to the fortress of Bendery in Moldova, which was part of the Ottoman Empire at the time. I wrote in my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, throughout the beginning of the 18th century, Ukraine had become part of the Muscovite Empire after the defeat of Ivan Mazeppa, the last rebel against Peter. From this point until Hetman Orlik, that's the Mazeppist Hetman in exile, the likes of Mikhail Kanenko ran Ukraine, overseeing an oligarchy of huge landowners protected by a strong Moscow and a weak Poland. The defeat of Sweden by Peter meant that there was nowhere else for the Hetmanate to go but in exile. The defeat, as bad as the ruin, created a remarkable document that finally laid out in systematic form the political ideology of the Cossack host, the Orlik Constitution of 1710, sometimes called the Bendery Constitution. Hetmans like Ivan Skoropadsky, who died in 1722, he thought he could reason with Peter. He could regain the trust that Mazeppa had lost. That fighting Peter was impossible, therefore negotiations were the only option he had. Mazeppa and Charles ended up in exile in Turkey for a while via Moldova. And then Skoropadsky was succeeded by Daniel Apostol, who died in 1734, who was a great landowner himself. I mean, so was Mazeppa, but he spent most of his money on locally. And he oversaw really the destruction of Cossack autonomy, because the destruction of Cossack autonomy was to protect the wealthy landowners that had grown up in the Hetmanate. Skoropadsky and Apostol fought against Mazeppa. I mean, they sided with him very early on, but then turned on him. They sought an alliance with Peter. The Cossack host was completely demoralized. The Ukrainian world, the Cossack world, was subsumed within the empire of Peter the Great, a very different empire than what had come before. Poland was largely destroyed, at least temporarily. Turkey was increasingly irrelevant. Sweden had been defeated. The elimination of powerful alternatives was dwindling. Now, of course, this war continued after 1709, but the shattered Swedish army on the continent was largely incapable of any action after that. Russia took Vyborg, which is close to St. Petersburg, in 1710, defeating all Swedish attempts to retake it. Finland was captured under the command of Admiral Fyodor Apraksin. He gathered his army of 15,000 men at Vyborg and started the operation against Finland in late August of 1712. Sweden was able to face him with only about 7,500 men. It was now the Swedes using scorched earth tactics. The Swedish efforts to maintain any kind of defenses had this, it was a problem, because the army on the continent was constantly draining them. All these garrisons around the Baltic Sea that they had won now becomes very expensive. And again, as I mentioned, the plague outbreak had struck Finland and Sweden, not just Ukraine, between 1710 and 1713. Half the population of Helsinki was killed by it. A fleet of coastal ships was put together by Apraksin, although Peter was there, with about 12,000 Russian Marines, as well as infantry and artillery, sailed from Kronstadt in 1713, arriving in May at Helsinki. Now only 1,800 infantrymen from Sweden was able to control them. This is under General Carl Gustav Armfelt. And that began the Battle of Helsinki. The Russians had roughly 20,000 men at their disposal. The Swedes had to pull back and destroyed what they could. But the bulk of the Russian forces moved along the coast towards Borga. 10,000 Russians, mostly Marines, landed in May of 1713, constructed fortifications in the Swedish shores. These stores of supplies were transported from Vyborg and St. Petersburg to this new base. Once Liebecker's army of 7,000 men tried to avoid contact with the Russians, they kept using the same Russian tactics against them. They were withdrawing further inland. They wouldn't even contest a lot of these coastal cities. But that severed the contact between the Swedish fleet, which was first rank, and their infantry. Not to mention the ships then couldn't supply the infantry anymore. At this point, the Swedes were going anywhere for soldiers. Most, in this case, were Finns. Armfelt was ordered to command the army. Advancing Russians were engaged at Palkane in October of 1713. The Swedes barely avoided getting encircled. The Swedes responded by severing supplies. The supply route around the Hungo Cape, the very most extreme southern part of Finland. So now they had to be carried overland. A Swedish coastal squadron. Sweden was in the verge of collapse. The Russian fleet was met at the Battle of Hungo. It was overpowered by the Russians, who had 10 times their numbers. Swedish fleet, just like the infantry, had to withdraw to prevent the Russian navy from hitting Sweden. By 1714, the Russian army had occupied most of the country of Finland. After Charles XII died, Sweden refused to make any peace treaty with Russia, at least not on Peter's terms. You did have some Russian raiding in 1716, 1717, the island of Gotland, to raid for supplies. A fleet was sent to the eastern coast of Sweden in 1719. A very large Russian task force was sent with 30,000 Marines. And to Peter's discredit, this was a raiding and plundering expedition. Many of the towns along the island make up of Stockholm, and many of these were burned. The British, it shouldn't surprise you, suddenly discovered their alliance with Sweden. They weren't able to catch the raiders, which were, you know, Russian regulars, Russian naval regulars. But seeing how powerful Russia was becoming, of course, the entire Western European world had to fall in behind Sweden. But each former member of the anti-Swedish coalition, like, for example, Denmark signed its own treaty in 1720 with Sweden. And this went from, you know, one region to another. And each one of these treaties meant that the Swedes could dedicate more men. This is like 1720 now. And can dedicate more men to preventing Russian expansion. But the Battle of Grengum, I don't think I'm pronouncing that right, ended the raids in 1720. As they were negotiating for peace, Russian raiding, which was kind of not exactly a knightly way of going about things, especially in the northern regions, Umeå to the far north, Gävle, Pattaya, these places, so that the Swedes would come to the table. And despite all of that, though, this is what happened. Now, in my opinion, what caused Sweden to lose this war so badly? And I've come up with a handful of reasons. And these are not comprehensive. Sweden was too small against Russia. Russia was, even parts of it, were too large and varied to traverse, with few serviceable roads. As I've already mentioned, the 1709 winter did a number on the Continental Army of Charles. After Russia was defeated at Narva, Sweden and Charles in particular became overconfident. Peter had no respect for life. He would throw whatever he could at an opponent. Mazeppa was a big disappointment. He only had a handful of men. And besides all that, Sweden was fighting far from home. And in the meantime, Russia had revised her military doctrine and had very quickly retooled her armed forces. And maybe Charles was simply too young. The other problem was that Sweden's sources of income were the main battlefield. Charles may have misread. Yeah, there was a lot of hatred towards Peter in Russia, but what that meant politically was misread by Charles. Charles simply wasn't kept up to date on Russian military reform. I mentioned the plague already. During the war, the Swedish army reached its high of 150,000 men. It could not be supplied with the same discipline that it famously had. The partisan attacks and Russian irregulars were coordinated. Supply lines could not keep up with this fast-moving cavalry force. And if you're going to rely on speed, you can't do it in Russia on difficult and very unfamiliar terrain. So ultimately, I think the real reason is that Sweden didn't have the resources for any kind of war of attrition. And I think Peter the Great was aware of that. Hanover, Brandenburg, Prussia, they negotiated their own peace treaties with Sweden. The two treaties of Stockholm, 1720, and thus began the partitioning of Swedish possessions all throughout the Baltic area. But the French were mediating a lot of this, and because they saw how powerful Russia was getting, they did everything in their power to prevent the total collapse of Sweden's position. Hanover, Brandenburg, Prussia incorporated Pomerania, which meant they had uncontested access to the sea. The British very rapidly fought briefly for the Swedes, but the anti-Swedish coalition had largely fallen apart by 1720. Denmark signed its own separate peace, and Denmark had been badly damaged and couldn't really try to get back its eastern provinces. But when peace came, the Swedes kind of were convinced that the politicians in Austria and France, they've already mentioned, would create a coalition to stop Russia. Because everyone knows that Russia shouldn't be permitted to do anything. This is a long-standing black mark on the European way of thinking. Now, of course, the War of Spanish Succession, which would have created the possibility of a huge Catholic megastate between France and Spain. Of course, the plan that the Swedes thought about never came to pass. The war finally ended. The Treaty of Nystad between only the two powers, Russia and Sweden, in August of 1721. The only thing the Swedes got back was Finland. But everything that the Russians sought to take, Estonia, Livonia, portion of Karelia, Ingria, all of this, all throughout the southern eastern portion of the Baltic Sea, were granted to Russia. And there were many other very brief wars from 1741 to 1790, but they didn't dislodge the Russians at all. That means that we're dealing with a period in European history that Russia is a great power. Of course, a century later, Napoleon will solidify that reputation. The goal of establishing maritime trade with Europe was reached. The war did plunge Russia into an economic crisis. There was a diminution in households, but not in terms of population. Now, I don't know if this has to do with new lands that it brought into itself. This 39% increase in population between 1678 and 1719 may well come from new lands being taken. But when you go from 1700 to 1721, the entire length of the Great Northern War, you have about 400,000. That's the only increase in this period of time. And of course, the war and Peter's reforms were so deadly, especially the latter, that, of course, Russia continued to grow in population, but the rate was very, very low. And that, my friends, is the significance of Poltava, which is being talked about every day now, and what this means for the development of the Russian Empire, for better or for worse. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.